Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden has selected California Senator Kamala Harris as his running mate as the nation passes 160,000 coronavirus fatalities. Nearly another 1 million Americans applied for unemployment insurance, although that is offset by slightly higher rehiring rates. With negotiations at an impasse with congressional Democrats, President Trump has signed executive orders to cut payroll taxes and tried to force states to pick up federal government unemployment burdens. Other negotiations with lawmakers are at a standstill, including on the NDAA and the appropriations processes. Here to discuss all this and more are Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm Capital Alpha Partners, Mackenzie Eaglin of the American Enterprise Institute, Dr. Gordon Adams of the Quincy Institute think tank, and Dr. Dove Zakheim, a former Pentagon comptroller who is a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Everybody, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us.
All right, Dove. Let's start us off on the budgetary situation. We do a coordinating set of emails on this. Mackenzie brought up the $11 billion the Pentagon wants to cover coronavirus-related charges in a stimulus package. Byron brought up the Treasury outlays, which are always something worth paying attention to. You were a former Pentagon comptroller, and better than anybody knows how the government budgets at a fundamental basis were. But start us off on what the president's gambit, which is kind of problematic, cutting Social Security, right? The payroll tax, it goes into the Social Security Trust Fund, and that's a third rail in American electoral politics, especially in an election year, especially a big one like this one. Talk to us about what the president's actions are doing and whether or not it increases or decreases leverage and what it does ultimately to the NDAA and appropriations process, given that the president has now done it, right? Last week, we were talking about it in theoretical terms.
Well, the first thing to say is that the president seems to, he doesn't read very much. So he evidently hasn't read Article 1 of the Constitution, which gives the Congress the power to tax and spend. So he's end running that. So the whole approach of these executive actions is questionable right there. And beyond that, reducing the payroll tax, as you mentioned, eats into the Social Security Trust Fund. And it's fascinating that though in so many cases the Republicans have followed Mr. Trump almost slavishly, there was a lot of pushback on the payroll tax issue because they know that you don't talk about Social Security at the best of times, and you certainly don't do that 85 days before Election Day. So he's created a problem, I think, for Republicans generally, and perhaps for himself as well. If he wants to get votes from seniors, this is not the best way to go about it. Now, the ramifications are such that if this thing holds up, they're going to have to find some kind of money to make sure they can tell the public that the trust fund is whole and healthy, which it really wasn't even before then. Where's the money going to come from? Not clear. But one thing we can say, I think, or at least I can say with certainty, is that it's going to be very, very difficult to plus up defense or meet this $11 billion requirement that the DOD is saying the contractors need as part of any other rescue package. First, because it's not clear there is a rescue package other than these four executive orders. And secondly, because there's going to be pressure, not just on defense, but on the budget generally, to find some kind of money to offset this payroll tax. What the president has really done is taken a spade that already had been digging a deep hole for Republicans and just adding to its depth.
What's your take? I mean, has the president dug himself into a hole? And how does his move, as somebody who used to sit in the Office of Management and Budget and knows better than almost anybody else, right? You and Dove actually lived the whole idea of authorities and the Constitution and what you can do. In fact, I remember how unpopular you were with some people in the administration sometimes when you would remind them about what it is they could and could not spend money on. How is this ultimately going to play out and impact the outlook for defense, both near term and maybe slightly longer term?
Well, this is obviously a president who lives against the rules. Rules were not made to constrain him. And frankly, in almost every one of the executive order slash memoranda that he did, he's testing not only the fringe, but probably the outer boundaries and on the other side of the authorities that the president has to do these things. So in the end, what that means is a lot of this may get locked up in court cases, highly contested. It might add some fuel to the fire on the congressional side, the people still trying to cut a deal, although the last 24 hours suggests the lines are hardening, not softening. In any case, some of what he's done in the executive orders is essentially unexecutable. Either the resources aren't there, or it's not clear that Treasury has worked out the way that certain benefit packages might actually work. And the politics, I think, are not working out for him. So it's kind of a smash and grab, slapdash way of trying to govern your way through the situation by trying to make it look to the electorate like you're doing something about it when you're really not doing anything about it.
Mackenzie, how is your sense on how this affects everything, including the $11 billion that the Pentagon wants? As we were going through this, you kind of noted that it's not a public memo, but everybody in Washington has it and has been talking about it. Welcome to D.C.
Exactly. Well, unfortunately, Congress recessing with the possibility of coming back and now combined with these executive orders, I really think, this is going to be a very long, hot, quiet rest of the summer. There will be no stimulus package potentially until even discussions resume in mid-September. So that's for clarity's sake, that's where we are. And I do think the executive orders added more poison in the well, which wasn't necessarily needed because there was already enough ill will. So that's unfortunate. And then, of course, every hour you inch closer to the election, everything gets harder to do. And they're not here. There are fewer and fewer legislative days left with both chambers in Washington. So it's already going to be a Herculean task to get another stimulus bill. I do think, though, there will be pressure to do it, even though it's going to be hard and even though it's going to be late and it's going to be September. I think that with resurgent cases in a variety of places and, this fight over the National Guard funding, Title 10 or 32, and the president only paying for it in certain states, the use of the guard with federal dollars. That's to me is sort of symbolic of the larger pressure that's going to come on him. It's universal from both parties that he should be picking up the tab wherever possible. And I think we're going to see this with the stimulus, with the $11 billion for the defense industrial base specifically, right? So Ellen Lord had testified that was roughly the number needed. Chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, Adam Smith, and ranking member of Senate Defense Appropriations Committee, Senator Durbin, had written this op-ed saying, this is a lack of detail, no blank checks for the Pentagon, which, of course, this is for mostly suppliers and vendors in tier 2, 3, and 4 for the primes. But the Pentagon finally responded, and it took long enough. And to their credit, though, although I really ding them on the delay, to their credit, the response is quite detailed and very useful. They give specific plants and facilities and locations and impact. And what's even, aside from the details of that, which we could get into if anyone wanted to, what's most important is that you
saw... Why don't you give us a little taste of what's in there? I mean, obviously our audience can find the details of it, but if you were going to sketch out sort of the most prominent features of it, and Byron, we can get your take on this too, on what you thought were the key takeaways, but what were some interesting elements of that?
Sure. Well, the Navy is of great concern in particular. One, they're worried about the critical loss of skill sets permanently. Like, for example, welders are called out specifically. And ask any shipyard, it's already hard enough to find engineers, welders, solderers, et cetera. So this is something that they're watching really closely to make sure that they keep employment. The memo speculates that a shipyard could shut down temporarily, but that the ramifications of that, however long temporary is, could obviously last for 12 to 18 months beyond that. Specifically, the Virginia-class attack submarine production line is also highlighted, not just in the memo, but in a phone call, in an earnings call. But basically, because Newport News had to prioritize the smaller workforce that is coming in to do maintenance for subs that are in service, and aircraft carriers, the attack submarine new production line had to slow. And so then that the outcome of this is that you saw just this week, Assistant Secretary of the Navy Hondo Gertz saying, here's the deal. If we don't get that $11 billion, because Chairman Smith is saying, you know, you got enough money to take it out of Hyde. And what Hondo said was, if you do that to us, we're going to take it out of procurement, specifically SCN dollars, shipbuilding procurement dollars. And that's, of course, the most protected and cherished pot, I'd argue, of almost any in the defense budget. And they're saying it's going to come out of these other priorities that you love. So please give us stimulus money.
Although I have to say that when Hondo did speak to reporters, he said that that shipyard closure issue was based on an early, very, very early in the pandemic, an assessment of, hey, if the, you know, the disease did get bad enough at a shipyard, yes, it could temporarily close. So he did mm-hmm. did put a little bit of distance there. On that issue. Byron, let's go to you. You've been tracking outlays. You're looking at this issue as well as sort of the broader budgetary dynamic. And next week is going to be political convention season, obviously starts with the Democrats now that Joe Biden has picked Kamala Harris as his running mate. Talk to us a little bit about, you know, outlays, what you're seeing and what you think is most interesting about the $11 billion request, and ultimately where you think we end up on all of this.
Well, I absolutely agree with Mackenzie's point that, look, this isn't a cost that the DOD can just eat. You know, these are allowable costs. And I think, you know, if the DOD is forced to eat these, it's going to be very disruptive. I do believe, you know, I suppose the other thing that came out, because we just more or less finished earnings season, you know, there were some delays that were evidenced on the Virginia class submarine that was in the Huntington Ingalls report. But, you know, more broadly, a lot of the contractors, at least through June, seem to be weathering this. And I think this kind of gets back to the outlay number that got reported in the monthly Treasury statement, where operations and maintenance outlays in July were pretty stable compared to a year ago. Actually, they're almost flat. And, you know, if you looked at the underlying budgets, what the total full year projections were for O&M outlays, they're actually up. So there still may be some wiggle room there. I've got to believe the DOD recognized some savings from, you know, basically the stand down on travel and the changes in military exercises. But I'm not sure, and I think that's the signaling with the memo, that, you know, there's not a lot of spare cash kind of sitting around as a result of those changes. And so there's some need for relief here. The other part about the outlay, and I think, you know, it kind of spins back to the prior conversation with Dove and with Gordon, and that's just the magnitude of the federal budget deficit. The July number actually showed, I think it was only about a $65 or $66 billion deficit, but that's because of the timing of tax receipts. If you recall, you know, tax day got moved from April 15th to July 15th. But on a trailing 12-month basis, we're still running a $3 trillion deficit. And that's before, you know, we get through the coming months and whatever Washington eventually does with fiscal stimulus. I do think that it's going to be fascinating to see how this starts to roll through state and local budgets and the pressures that they're going to see this fall without some sort of help from Washington, D.C.
Let me ask a broader question of Dove and Gordon, given the experience you have. I'm not dating you, gentlemen, but just in your experience in government, do you have any precedent, both for the degree of a revenue drop, but second, that an administration would try to direct more National Guard money to blue states than he would to red states? I mean, has that ever happened for any president you guys have either worked for or covered or seen? Or
I had to deal with the question of Title 32 and Title 10 during the beginning of the Afghanistan war. And in those days, the states all wanted it to be Title 10 money for, you know, for letting the Guard go overseas. We wanted it to be primarily Title 32 money. It wound up being mostly Title 10 money. But I don't recall distinguishing between red states and blue states at all. I mean, it just didn't happen. By the way, on the previous set of comments, particularly about the Navy, but not just the Navy. When I got into this business a million years ago, the Navy was complaining about a shortage of fitters and welders. And one of their problems was that a lot of these folks were going to oil rigs. Well, they're not going there now. And so, number one, as soon as they can come back, they're going to come back. These are not people permanently lost. Number two, my good friend who succeeded me but one as comptroller, Bob Hale, really a terrific comptroller, maybe the best we've had in a long, long time, he was having to deal with the whole government close down. And he basically moved monies around to deal with the not exactly the same problem. He had to pay people, but he moved monies around from unobligated balances. And it just seems to me that there will be, there are always vehicles when you're a comptroller, and McKenzie knows this too, as does Gordon. There's always money sloshing around when you're really in an emergency. And so if they don't get their $11 billion, let's say they get some of it, I think the Pentagon will figure out a way to meet the difference, both in terms of personnel that have to be hired and in terms of the money. These are legitimate claims. DCAA is not going to invalidate any of those. That's the Defense Audit Agency, which, again, works for the comptroller. This is not as big a problem, perhaps, as those crying wolf would have you believe.
I have to say, at the risk of sounding like me too, I think Dove's absolutely right on this. I was listening to the list that McKenzie reeled off, and my thought at the time was any decent comptroller like a Dove Zakheim could find a way to do most of this. This is not a huge charge in a $740 billion budget. And there's always some give and take within accounts. There's always give and take within unobligated and as opposed to obligated balances. If you pose the problem to me and I were DOD comptroller and you said it's an $11 billion problem, find me a way through it. The precedent for me is the really interesting and in some ways quite successful way that the department managed the sequestration the year it happened, with forewarning of dire consequences to the evaporation of American national security and a stand down of forces as we knew it. We got through that fine. And the Pentagon did a pretty damn good job of managing how you get through a decline in resources of that time of that kind. So my own view is I'm not terribly sympathetic. I'm kind of in Adam Smith and Dick Durbin's camp. It's, come on, guys. A smart and savvy comptroller like a Bob Hale or a Dove Zakheim can walk through this particular jungle and cut the undergrowth away and find a way to move the pieces around so it works. It's not that complicated.
Fago, yes, we got through it.
Go ahead.
I'm going to jump through the phone. Yeah, we got through it, for sure. And they're both right. Dove is 100%. Bob Hale was skillful, just tremendously skillful. We owe him a debt of gratitude for groping through that nightmare of sequestration and then partial shutdown. But then we had a $500 billion hole that had to be dug out of, and Jim Mattis took the job as secretary, looked around and said, what the heck is going on? Why is readiness through the floor? Why are Navy ships colliding in the Pacific in peacetime? Because sailors can't drive ships. I mean, it was a bloodbath.
There were a lot of other reasons associated with those collisions other
totally,
than
totally merely McKenzie, I'm not hanging those collisions.
Hold on. Let her finish the point, okay. And then Byron, we're going to go to you. Okay.
Generically speaking, readiness took a nosedive and services and fleets and inventory suffered. But here's what my bigger point. Why should the Defense Department be punished for a pandemic that wasn't its fault, which then led to, issues with contracts and delays? And, if we were pursuing legal remedies akin to acts of God, that would be a reasonable justification. They shouldn't have to eat it out of hide because they didn't bring the pandemic on themselves in their contracts. It's not their fault.
The other people are pretty good about finding money in the DOD budget or Senate and House appropriators, particularly, the rescissions that you see in each year's bill. And I think in this year's FY21 markup, there was about $4 billion in rescissions to the FY20 budget. So I just wonder, I agree there's probably some money there, but I kind of also agree more with Mackenzie that this is a unique circumstance, and it's kind of unfolded over time when, you know, certainly the budget when it was crafted didn't foresee this, and I don't know how much visibility there was when appropriators went after this as well. So I don't think it's something that the DOD could just, you know, slough off the water off the back of a duck type of event. I think if they don't get relief, you'll see this roll through programs.
Well, wait a minute. Nobody's saying that they can't survive, that they can just slough it off. First of all, as you guys all know, right, you don't need an $11 billion upfront payment. We're talking right about money spread over time, which, by the way, was what Bob Hale did during the whole the crisis that he faced, which, by the way, was for the DOD just as much an act of God as the pandemic. Let's be honest. DOD didn't create that problem either. So it's a matter of how you deal with it over time. And because you've got time here, initially, I think the department can manage. Now, if this thing goes on 6 months, 7 months, 8 months more, then I would certainly agree with Byron and Mackenzie that this cannot go on. But I think for the short term, and certainly until we know who the next president is, they probably could squeak by. It won't be easy. It'll be painful. And oh, by the way, of course, money coming out of unobligated balances is a very different thing in general from money for O&M, which usually gets spent pretty quickly.
Well, and just to follow
up. All correct. But, you know, basically, I think what we're dealing with, you know, the time phasing here of this kind of problem and the way in which you can deal with it in cash flow terms, in my judgment, is manageable, and it's manageable within the department's resources. I don't think it's a question of punishing the department. It's a question of what's manageable within the department's resources. There are so many other needs here that are going to be needing to be met that aren't being met because of the lack of an agreement on an overall package, new package for the COVID pandemic. But, you know, they vastly and mammothly outweigh $11 billion worth of consequence in the operations of contractors. It would really be, the question here is whether the contractors are being punished, and they're not being punished because the Department of Defense can find the resources to work through this problem. I agree with Dove. If this goes on year or two more and ends up being a sort of an endless supply chain issue and an endless factory workforce availability issue, then you're going to have to relook at it. But right now, I don't think this is a crying priority.
Byron, you wanted to say something. You get the last word on this.
One point I was going to add, it didn't come up in all the earnings reports. I think the other factor that I think was fascinating here, and it maybe goes back to the outlay question, procurement and RDT&E outlays were up around 8 or 7%. So, you know, the Treasury report never details this, but there was an acceleration or plus up to progress payment rate. So maybe what we all need is a little bit more clarity about what exactly the cash flow statements look like for the Department of Defense and just what is, sure, there are lots of anecdotes about what could happen, but from the outside looking in, certainly there wasn't a lot of duress shown by contractors in their June quarter reports. And I think you have to wonder, you know, they were incurring these expenses that were allowable. Some of that, and maybe a lot of that, was covered by the accelerated progress payment rates. And then they must have had some of their own savings too, because there weren't conferences, there weren't the big trade shows, people weren't traveling as much. But right, kind of squaring this all together, the money has to come from somewhere. When and how that happens, I absolutely agree with Dove and Gordon's point. There's probably a phasing question here, but it's a hole that will be made up somewhere along the way. And if it's not, there's going to be an impact.
Let's move on because we have two important questions. Obviously, UAE, Israel news, and Dove, I want to get your take on that. But more importantly, last string of primaries is over. We have a QAnon or several QAnon candidates. I believe one is the Republican from Oregon and the other one is Marjorie Greene in Georgia that was originally criticized by Republican leaders but now embraced, including by the president. And of course, Vice President Biden has pick Kamala Harris as his running mate. The Democratic convention will be next week. Dove, why don't you start us off, and I want to quickly go around the horn on what you think this choice means for national security. And by that, I also mean homeland security. And what messages and clarity, right? What are you guys as seasoned Washington budget and policy people looking forward to hearing next week at what is going to be a remote convention, but we'll also have, right, national security voices that will be involved in it, and we'll also have the full and final platform, if I'm not mistaken, is going to get released here very shortly. So, Dove, why don't you start us off, Gordon, Mackenzie, and then Byron.
What I think is most important is what was in that old Sherlock Holmes story, The Dog That Didn't Bark. Kamala Harris did not support a 10% cut of the defense budget, the Bernie Sanders AOC squad approach to how to deal with defense. And I don't think that given Joe Biden's background and her position, that you're going to see this radical cutting of defense. Will there be something about how defense needs to be managed, how it shouldn't grow as much, how it may perhaps shouldn't grow at all? For sure. But fundamentally, she's been very open about the fact that she doesn't want radical change. That's the reason that he chose her anyway. I mean, look, Wall Street is happy with the choice. Not so much that they're happy with the Democrats, but they're happy that it could have been a lot worse. It could have been somebody from the Bernie Sanders wing of the party, and it isn't. And so the choice, which many predicted anyway, probably was as safe one as one could hope for. Now, she is involved and has been involved in Homeland Security. Remember that Homeland Security also includes the Coast Guard. She may have something to say about that. She's not particularly pro-Russian or even nice about the Russians. And the Coast Guard, of course, is concerned about the Arctic. So we may hear something about that, although that may be too far in the weeds. More likely, she may be talking about the use of the military in a near posse comitatus manner, that is to say, more types of issues like you had at Lafayette Square, where she's clearly going to be against that. But I think the sentiment of the majority of the country is against that, too, and against the way it worked. So I think bottom line, she's not going to say much about national defense per se. Nor, I think, will the convention, other than the usual bromides about how defense needs to be controlled.
And I should also point out that Bernie Sanders, or at least his spokesman, criticized Kamala Harris for not being, and Biden for not being progressive enough, for picking somebody and embracing somebody as progressive as I think that wing of the party wanted, although it's impressive how quickly everybody has banded together on that. Gordon, as the Democrat on this bunch, what do you...
I was going to say, in part, what you just expressed, and that is that the Democratic Party is so anxious to get rid of Donald Trump that they will probably gather forces around a brick if that were named to be vice president's candidate. She is, in a sense, a perfect choice to make no big waves while making big waves, which is the interesting thing about her selection, because as a person of color, both the first Indian American on a national ticket, the first African Jamaican American to the vice presidency. As a female candidate for the vice presidency, she's the fourth in history. This is just about as undamaging, if not great, a choice as Biden could have made. And I think all the wings of the party are going to really coalesce very quickly around this, because the anxiety to get out the vote and get rid of Donald Trump is high in the Democratic Party, and pretty well organized too. That said, does her appointment mean anything for defense? You know, frankly, this is a candidate for the vice presidency of the United States. There are very few vice presidents who have had a huge impact on defense, Dick Cheney being a very notable exception. She is not going to be a major player on national security issues. She doesn't come with a big background on national security issues. Her voting positions and her bill positions have always been pretty moderate in terms of the Democratic Party political space. The issue for defense is not going to be Kamala Harris. The issue for defense, especially in the first year, is going to, as we said many times in this program, is going to be the very first 6 months of a Biden-Harris administration, and they are going to be driven by the overarching issues of the pandemic and the huge deficits that we're now encountering and what the strategy of the incoming administration is going to be to deal with those. And that's going to be a decision very much centered in Biden and in the White House advisors. And yes, Harris will be there, but we don't know how deeply yet. But she is not somebody, she doesn't come like Dick Cheney, knowing a lot more about defense than the president and knowing how to drive the train. It's not her bailiwick. So the big issues about the defense budget don't change significantly from where I've been, at least on this program before, which is we're flat, maybe reductions in real dollars, maybe an absorption in the base of some of that stuff that's been absorbed in the OCO account. It's going to be difficult times for the way the services have actually forecast defense in the FYDP. There's going to be a lot of adjustments made.
Mackenzie?
The lens through which I look at Senator Harris's national security views is through the committees that she sits on in Senate, because that's where a senator spends most of their time when the chamber is in session. So she's on intelligence, homeland security, and budget. And I would say, you know, those three together probably make her slightly more hawkish than, you know, but that she's still, as I think Gordon accurately said, she's pretty moderate in terms of responsibly drawing down in Afghanistan has been her position in the past as well. Pretty harsh on Saudi Arabia, though, saying that we should end U.S. support for the war in Yemen and end arms sales to Saudi Arabia. I don't think, you know, the Department of Defense would agree with either completely, but, you know, so that gives you a little bit of sampling. Her biggest issues have actually been with members of the administration. She voted against the confirmation of Mark Esper, Secretary of Defense, for example, partly because of, or mostly, I guess you could say, because of his ties to industry. That could be the one stamp she has on defense, potentially. I agree with Gordon, it's not going to be significant. But if she feels that strongly about it, you know, that would change the what I think could be the traditional expected lineup roster for Pentagon appointees in a potential Biden administration. It's hard to get a lot of good people at the top without industry ties and experience, and it would be a shame to limit, I think, that bench, but it's possible that might be a priority she pushes for.
Byron?
I agree with a lot of what's been said. I think the interesting thing, though, is Biden's age, you know, if he's elected, and how this may position Harris for 2024 if Biden doesn't run for a second term. The vice president is usually the presumptive party nominee, so 2024 is still a long way away, but I think, you know, there's a pathway here where I agree. I don't think it really matters that much for defense. It's really going to be more about, you know, what Biden wants to do, certainly in his first year, and then who else he picks for the other key positions, SecDef, OMB, his National Security Council. And then obviously, you know, what takes place around the world that may confound some of the initial plans that are set for the first year of his administration.
And the markets have received this pretty well, haven't they?
More or less. I mean, defense actually was off a little bit. I think she's probably, you know, I don't think the defense contractors, the market may be expecting a Biden win right now, but I don't think they've really fully discounted what that may mean. I mean, we talk about flat defense budgets, but, you know, what programs are going to get cut in that environment? Biden's talked about a tax plan that would raise corporate tax rates. I haven't seen anybody take their 2022 earnings estimates down for a 28% corporate tax rate. So it's hard to say, you know, kind of separate all that and specifically how some of the defense, the large cap defense stocks.
All right. We have a limited amount of time left. Dove, let me just get your sense on the UAE-Israel deal. It looks like the normalization of relations between Abu Dhabi and Jerusalem is predicated on Israel not annexing the rest of the West Bank, as was its plan. Obviously, these are two countries that behind the scenes have had a very close relationship, somewhat more acknowledged by Israelis than Emiratis historically, including spy satellites that Israel has manufactured, something that Israel won't comment on, that the UAE denies, but I think most people recognize was in fact the case. Talk to us a little bit about what this all means for the dynamic reordering of lines across the Middle East, including in the Gulf region.
Well, I'm a little underwhelmed by all of this, quite frankly. I mean, I see this, you've got a president who's known for a while that he's in trouble electorally. You've got a prime minister of Israel who is also in trouble, is under indictment, is about to see his government collapse, and was told by one part of his base, the ultra-Orthodox parties, that they're not going to support him if the government collapses, because that means they don't get the budget money for their schools. And here comes the smartest man in the Middle East, Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed, who says, okay, I can help you guys out. And he does. But, and here's the key, the Israelis are saying, we're not really stopping annexation. We're suspending annexation. But if you look at what Sheikh Mohammed has tweeted, he said, they're stopping annexation. At the same time, the Israelis are saying, oh, and President Trump, this is a move to relations and giving the impression that you'll see an Israeli embassy with an Israeli flag in Abu Dhabi. That is not what Sheikh Mohammed has tweeted. He has tweeted, we're going to work out a roadmap for relations. Well, they already have relations. You just pointed that out. So it seems to me that everybody's going to owe Sheikh Mohammed something for doing this. The Palestinians are obviously annoyed, but what can they do about it? Frankly, let's see what happens here. This may be blown out of proportion, which in fact is not unusual for this particular president.
Mackenzie, Gordon, or Byron, anything you guys want to add?
It's a significant development, and I think it's going to be hard for anyone to give President Trump any credit. I'm sure the groundwork was laid many years before this. In fact, in my visit to the Middle East, to UAE and to Israel, in fact, on the same trip, I could tell you 10 years ago that, you know, when you have a common enemy in Iran, this is how things can turn. But I think the president deserves a little credit here and his team.
Gordon?
I'm not sure how much credit goes to Trump on this, but what it tells you is that the tentacles of political relationships in the Middle East are vastly more complicated than what the United States government thinks it can accomplish. These kinds of relationships have gone on over the table, under the table, around the table, behind the table for some years now, actually, with some of this early stuff, as Double certainly know, going way back into the 1980s, 1990s. So it's not too surprising here, and it's not too surprising to me that each side would interpret the meaning of the agreement in a slightly different way. Welcome to the Middle East. What it suggests to me is that a certain amount of humility about the expectation that the United States is driving the traffic of relationships in this region. A lot of it is being driven by the complexities of the relationships among the parties themselves. And this is just one that pops up above the surface.
Everybody, thanks so very much for joining us. We really appreciate it and look forward to having you guys back next week to assess what either will be the dullest political convention we've ever seen or an interesting one. Where are you guys voting? Dull, interesting?
I'll say different.
Different. Okay. Well done, Dove. Well done.
The media will describe it as different, and they will salivate all over it as to how different it is. My expectation is it will be quite dull, hopefully very dull.
Exactly. Guys, thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.